Hello and welcome to Hunt, Find, Alert, the Canine Search and Rescue podcast, where we discuss everything related to the world of canine search and rescue work. As always, I'm your host, Zephyrin Allen. Thank you for joining us today. So today we have a discussion that multiple people have asked about, and so we are finally able to get to do it. So I'm excited about it. I hope the folks that are listening are going to be excited about it as well. And that topic is going to be turning shelter dogs into search dogs. So in order to explore this topic in depth, I've invited Christy Borman onto the show. Christy, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on tonight.
Great. Well, we appreciate you taking the time to join the show. So what we like to do, Christy, before we dive into the actual topic, is to get to know you a little bit better, find out about you, what you've done in search and rescue and kind of your history. So let's start there. First question is, how long have you been involved in search and rescue, and how did you get started in SAR?
So it's a really fun story. Started officially in canine search and rescue in 2002.
Okay.
I was working at the vet school at Texas A&M as a research assistant. We were working on a project that was attempting to clone a dog.
Oh,
and okay. So that's kind of how I got into dogs. Prior to that, I was a devout horse person. I was deep in the weeds, competing with horses in all kinds of different ways. And so I had a background in training animals, and I had a love for that. And I was looking for a career path post-college and working with these recipient dogs that were going to be the potential moms for these cloned dogs turned out to be my first job right out of college. And as will happen when you work at a vet clinic of any kind, people drop off a lot of animals.
Do they really? I didn't
know. Oh my goodness. All the time. There's a box outside the front door or something tied to the stair railing all the time.
Interesting. So is it like people who can't pay their bill? They're just like, hey, I don't want this dog. I'll take it to the vet's office.
All of the above, right? Okay. All of the above. And so there wound up being a literal box of puppies, and they looked like German Shepherd puppies that were very young. I didn't realize at the time how young and how probably bad this idea was, but they were about 5 weeks old. And I, as a horse person who was turning into dogs, knew that I needed a dog to ride in the front seat of the truck, because that's like a requirement if you're a serious horse person. So I picked out one of those puppies because I thought, man, a German Shepherd, this is going to be so cool. I have always wanted one of these. And my goodness, it was an absolute train wreck, like an absolute train wreck. I had knew nothing about raising a dog, and she turned out she had a lot of drive. And at one point my roommate said, fix this or find somewhere else to live.
Yeah, sounds like a search dog. Yeah.
Teensy bit tense conversation, but little did I know how that was going to shape my whole life. So I wound up putting her into an obedience class, and the obedience instructor said, like the very first night, the obedience instructor says, I think you should do search and rescue with this dog. And I'm just staring at this person with an open mouth, because this dog doesn't sit, doesn't come here, doesn't anything. And we were very soon after 9/11. So we had just seen all these amazing superhero dogs all over the news and all the great things they were doing. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I can't keep this thing from eating the couch.
Yeah.
And so it did a bit of a sell job. And I finally agreed to go out to my very first wilderness search team training. And I said, man, when they laugh at me, I'm not coming back. Like, I'm one and done. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And went, followed all the teams, took my dog. They took a look at her. And in the very end of the conversation, at the end of the evening, I said, well, what do you guys think? Which was a tactical error. I probably didn't want to know.
Yeah.
So they said, well, we think the dog can do the job. I said, oh man, that's cool. And then they said, but we're not real sure that this is for you. Because I'm not from Texas. I'm from the frozen Northland, and I really don't do reptiles. And I was pretty sure at that point in my career here that there was a reptile behind every blade of grass. So I had basically like stepped in everyone's tracks as we're going to work all these dogs in the wilderness. And I mean, now I actually know there is a reptile behind every blade
of
grass.
Yeah, I was going to say, you were right.
Like
it
was facts. Yeah. It was facts. But I have had to come to terms with that in a way that I can at least work out in the world. But man, that was really kind of a challenge for me because I was like, well, what do you mean she can do it, but I might not be able to do it? I could do this. Teensy bit stubborn and competitive. And so I kind of dove in, but I did it in a very non-committal way, right? Like I was the person that came out a couple times a month and kind of see how the dog was doing. And I was still actively riding my horse, but I had taken a break from competition because I was pretty burned out after I finished my college career. And I was getting close to being able to certify this dog for wilderness live find, because at the time, that's all that we did. If you wanted to do human remains at the time, it was as a cross-trained air scent dog. And so basically, you had to certify in live find, and then maybe you could do some HR.
Gotcha.
And I kind of knew that that interested me because I was, kind of a crime TV junkie already. But I didn't know what the path would look like to that. So I'm pretty close to getting ready to certify with this dog. And the universe did this thing. Like sometimes I think the universe tries to show you what the path should look like. And sometimes we listen very easily, and sometimes we have to be absolutely drop kicked by the world into the path that we're supposed to be on. I'm a drop kicker. So I was still hanging on to that horse. And I went out to feed him one morning, and there'd been a barn fire. And the barn had been destroyed, and the horses were scattered everywhere. And I managed to find my horse, but he only lived for a few days after that. So, of course, I was absolutely devastated. And, the people on my team really surrounded me and kept me in an okay mental space to be able to get through that. And then a few weeks later, I said, I'm still good to do this certification. Like, we've been working so hard. Like, please just let me do this. And I think they all knew, like, she needs to be distracted right now. Let her do it. Right. So we did that. And she passed the certification. And I said, oh my gosh. Okay. Now what I want to know is how to find dead people, because that's really cool. And they all just kind of stared at me like, what is wrong with you? Right. And I figured out how to get to my first seminar that would kind of teach me how to get started at finding human remains. And I left for that seminar. And when I got back, somebody had stolen my horse trailer and all the stuff I had left.
Wow. So you were done with horses at that point.
Well, and I went, okay, universe, I got it. We're doing a left-hand turn here into this dog thing. And I kind of dove all of the energy that I had put into that horse career, I pushed into the dogs thing.
Okay, cool.
And then I managed to certify her very quickly for human remains. And frankly, she never did another live find search after that certification day because she didn't actually like it and I didn't actually like it. So we leaned heavily into human remains detection. And it is to this day my favorite thing to do. And as we will do, right? Like you, many handlers do this, I think. You kind of get that first dog certified, settled in, do a couple of searches, and they're like, okay, I think I need another dog. Right? This is very common. So, by gosh, I got another dog and I was going to train that dog. And gosh, I have just followed a chain of dogs through certifications of different types and doing different kinds of search and rescue things ever since. So it's been really an awesome journey, and I'm excited to share that with new people that think they want to do it.
Yeah, that's cool. That's great. So I'm interested. Was the obedience instructor part of a search and rescue team? Because I you rarely
Yes.
hear. Okay, that's why they had
Yes.
the context. Okay, gotcha. So they were recruiting while they were teaching
Yeah.
class.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it worked out beautifully for me.
Okay, cool. So I think I would count 22 years then you've been doing this about.
Yes.
So what keeps you going? Like, what keeps you motivated to continue doing, the financial investment, the time investment, the emotional investment, what keeps you going doing SAR?
It's so many things, and I think it has to be many things for us to last a long time at this because it's incredibly taxing mentally, physically, financially. It's a really hard thing to keep doing for you and for your family and for everybody that your life kind of touches. The number one thing, the first thing that I love is I love, love, love training dogs. Love it. And frankly, it's fun to me to train a dog to do parkour and mushing and all the things, right? So, the wide variety of things that we do in search and rescue makes it so that we are never done with this, right? Like there are enough things to train these dogs to be good at that I can start on the very first day of their career. And the day before they retire, I still have a list of stuff right. that we should be getting better at. And so that works really well for my brain because I am easily bored. And these dogs and this specialty don't allow you to get bored if you're doing it well. Mm-hmm. So that keeps me motivated as well. And then really, truly, I get to work with some amazing handlers and we get to do amazing things for people on their very worst day. And I love to be able to do that. So it's all of those things. And I think if any of those things didn't motivate me, I wouldn't have been able to continue doing it this long.
All right. Good deal. The horse training experience that you have had, did that translate pretty well into training dogs, or was it apples and oranges?
You know, it really did help because I understood the importance of timing. And mm-hmm. that's a hard thing to teach somebody. I had been riding horses since I was very young. I was 6 when I started riding and had been continuously riding between those times. So lots of horses, and I learned a lot of things from a lot of different horses, right? Each horse is different in the same way that each dog is different. And you have to figure out how to work with the animal that you're partnered with, not just some generic creature. Yeah. And I think that's super translatable into the world of search and rescue because we have such a wide variety of dogs here. And the timing is so critical, right? Like I understood that if I do this thing, then the horse should do that thing. And then I release the pressure on him or her. And that translates well to the dogs. We were really swapping like pressure for rewards instead, right? Like with a horse, you want to kind of push and then they move to get away from the push and you release the push.
Okay.
Well, with the dog, I'm going to go, hey, I have this thing you want. Wouldn't you like to do something with me? So although we obviously also have corrections that can be used to push as well. So I think it has... moving from one to the other has been a pretty fun thing. And I see frequently when I'm out in the world walking around going, hey, that's a really talented handler. And they're very intrinsic trainer. They often have a background in training some other kind of animal before they came to the dog world.
Definitely. Yeah. I've had the same observation as well. So cool. So tell us a little bit about your team. Where are you located? What's the name of your team and what do you guys do?
So I'm a part of Category 5 Canines, and we are based in Lytle, Texas. It's a massive metroplex. Okay, it's a very small town. It's a very small town just southwest of San Antonio. Mm-hmm. We have a number of canines and handlers. So the Category 5 does a couple of things. One is we support the handlers of Texas A&M Task Force 1, and we do that in many ways. One of those ways is to provide them with an avenue to do some volunteer search and rescue on the side if they would like to do that. Mm-hmm. So we have a batch of dogs that are certified for both urban search and rescue and wilderness search and rescue in either Live Find or HR. And we make those folks available to law enforcement all over the state as best we can to help with whatever missions are ongoing for those law enforcement agencies or public safety agencies. So we do that. We also provide some training opportunities to those handlers that we wouldn't be able to do through the state search and rescue team. It can be things like workshops on maybe emergency first aid care for their dogs, or we just did a really great workshop on canine trigger point massage. So the handlers are able to do some trigger point work on their dogs when we're out on these long multi-day missions so they can find soft tissue issues and help resolve those before they become a game ender for the mm-hmm. mission. We also provide some grant dollars to help with things like care for retired dogs. We're working on a program for that right now for the retired dogs at Texas A&M Task Force 1. And then we try to find search partners for our new handlers or our handlers who are retiring dog and looking for a new partner. So in an effort to find those dogs, we have to look at a lot of dogs. And most of the dogs we find are through rescue or through owner surrender. We get contacted by people from all over the place of, I have a puppy and I want to donate it. And so we put together criteria that work for us to try to find dogs that need jobs and then get those dogs into jobs. And while we are always on the hunt for urban search and rescue dogs, we find lots of dogs that actually want to do some other job or are suited for some other job. So we've worked hard to build a network of programs that we can send those dogs to so that they can have their dream job for the rest of their career, because most of them will not be successful in a pet placement. Right. They're just too crazy.
Yeah.
And they need a job. So we like to be able to network those critters and get them to the trainers that want to use them for whatever they're going to do.
Cool. Cool. How big is the team?
Well, that's a great question. So we have a board of 5 people. Mm-hmm. We have, I think, 6 fosters right now that are holding onto dogs for the program in some form or fashion. And then we've got 14 people that are, I think 12 to 14 people that are canine handlers within that wilderness search capacity.
Cool.
So pretty small group.
Yeah. So one of the things that I don't think we've actually covered on any episode, and we had Tiffany Turner on with Ben a while back, but we didn't talk about it then.
Awesome.
There. But I'm going to ask you to do it.
Sure.
So you've mentioned both wilderness search and rescue and urban search and rescue. And there's a lot of people who listen to this podcast that are fairly new to search and rescue, so they may not actually know what you mean. So could you give us a minute and talk about the difference between wilderness SAR and urban SAR?
Absolutely. So urban search and rescue is really large-scale disaster response. And the way that we do that is through the state and federal disaster response systems. So our teams that are doing disaster response are doing that as a part of Texas A&M Task Force 1, which is one of 28 federal teams across the country that are set up with a wide variety of resources, from canine handlers to doctors to logistics specialists to hazmat specialists and rescue specialists. There's a huge team of people that goes out the door when a large-scale disaster happens. And what I'm talking about is hurricanes, large, long-track tornadoes, massive floods. These are the things that you're going to see on the news.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean the national news. Those teams will go and search the debris fields either for living victims who are trapped or people who were trapped and are now deceased, but always for people. And then the entire team comes together to then rescue those folks or recover those folks and get them either to medical care or to a coroner. So it's a huge organization that does that. And you are often deployed for long periods of time, like 10 to 14 days at a time, in an environment where you have to be self-sustaining. And I mean, eating MREs for a couple of weeks is not unheard of. It's not pleasant, but it's not unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what urban search and rescue is aimed at, is doing that kind of thing. And then wilderness search and rescue is an interesting thing. And I was thinking about this the other day. It's really kind of a misnomer, really. Wilderness kind of means and everything else, right?
Right.
So in your mind, you think wilderness, you think I'm searching in the woods. But the truth is, wilderness search and rescue in this country covers everything from large-scale wilderness response in big mountain country to crime scene search. Mm-hmm. And yep. So that's a really interesting thing to think about, is crime scene search, that's not anything to do with wilderness. It's kind of other, right? So I imagine in the next few years, somebody will come up with new terms for different definitions of things. But really, when we say wilderness response, what we mean is local level response. So a local police department that has a missing person or a cold case that they want to work to try to find the people missing in the cold case. And so you're really working on one or maybe a couple lost people. You have a good idea of how many you're looking for. When we're in a disaster environment, we don't know how many that is. It could be a lot. It could be nobody. We have no idea. Wilderness response is absolutely unpaid. Right? For disaster response, we are often paid for that. If we are deployed as a part of Texas Task Force 1, the handlers get paid for that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're covered by things like workers' comp, which are extremely important when you're in a very high-risk environment. So it's really interesting to do both things. Not every urban search and rescue team does go do wilderness search. We think it's important. We want to be able to use these dogs as much as we can. And I firmly believe that the more operational experience a team can get, the more valuable they are in on disaster day for us. Right. So we want to make sure that they are able to go do those things and serve their communities, whether it's a big thing or a small thing.
Okay, cool. Could you give me, maybe the last two, three or four disasters that you've personally responded to?
Sure. My last two disaster responses actually were both large scale fires. So a few weeks ago, I was deployed in support of the Smokehouse Fire in North Texas, burned over 1 million acres and hundreds of structures. I don't know what the count was at the end, but a lot. And so we were searching basically every home that had been burned to be sure that the people who lived in that home had been able to escape. So we did that in, we were in the area around Canadian, Texas.
Yep.
And then prior to that, my most memorable and largest response would have been the wildfire in Maui. So we went to Maui, and I think we were there for about 17 days. I could be wrong. But again, a large-scale wildfire that had destroyed thousands of structures, and we were searching to see if we could find the people who had not made it out.
Okay. All right. Good deal. Thanks for giving us that context. So,
sure.
So what I also like to do, because this is a dog podcast and everyone likes to talk about their dog. So tell us about your dogs just briefly, from your first dog, the German Shepherd that you got from the front porch of the vet clinic, to any dogs that you're currently working today.
Awesome. So it's a long and an inglorious list. That first dog was a German Shepherd mix. Her name was Lady, and she was a really interesting dog. She had a lot of drive, but my complete ignorance about how to raise a dog with a lot of drive meant that we had a lot of things that needed to be fixed for her entire career.
Mm-hmm.
She was not well socialized, and we did this weird thing where, you know, you can do drive building with dogs to help them really latch on to a reward, whatever their reward is going to be, right? Most people, smart people, do that on things like tug toys and tennis balls. Well, I didn't know what I was doing, and she decided that her favorite thing was a golf club. And so
Like a seven iron.
Her favorite was the seven, man. She loved a good seven iron.
What did she do with it? Like,
oh my goodness. It's so sad. So she would hook her nose under the end of the club and flip it up in the air. Like you'll see many dogs do with sticks or herding balls or something like that.
Yeah.
She would do that with it. And basically what happened was some friends were over hitting balls. I lived out in a rural area, and some friends came over and hit balls for her for hours, and she would shag those balls forever. Well, they put their clubs down to come in the house, and she's like, why did the magic stick stop throwing the ball? Make it work.
Yeah.
And from that point forward, she was absolutely obsessed with golf clubs, and everybody that came over wanted to see the funny dog play with the golf club. So all these people would get out the golf club and let her have it, and then of course they're cheering her on and laughing and loving it. So she got even more built into that toy. So I wound up carrying a sawed off seven iron for most of her working career. And every time I go teach now and somebody's like, well, I don't really want to tell you what his favorite toy is, I'm like, I bet I got one weirder.
It's like, you remember the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? I think you had Donatello with like the hockey stick, and he was like whipping out of his back. I can imagine you doing that. So
that was the one.
Do you have any videos of that? I have to post one on Facebook.
I will have to look. I know I've got a photo of her with it. I'm not sure if I have any video because, gosh, you know, it was back in the dawn of time and all.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, we'll take a photo.
I'll for sure find you a photo.
Cool.
I'm going to write that down before I forget. So After that, I picked up a second dog that, of course, I was going to train. And now this was going to be so much easier because I knew so many more things. And I think that's a line that we as search dog handlers sell ourselves all the time. No. The next one's going to be easier because I know more.
Yeah.
Was absolutely not the case ever. Because what worked for dog number one or two or seven isn't going to work for dog eight or nine.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned a lot of new things with him. Attempted certification with him. He was injured pretty catastrophically in between failing our first certification and fixing the things to go back for the second. He was injured badly enough that he couldn't finish out a career. So he wound up being my favorite couch dog, and frankly, probably the only good pet we've ever.
What type of dog was he?
A shepherd chow mix, because that seemed smart.
Yeah.
He
All
was very
right.
cute.
Yeah.
So I learned from him a lot of things about food drive and how to manage a dog that had some drive, but not enough drive per se. And then I got involved in the task force, Texas Task Force One,
Okay. And
and my
about what year was this when you joined the task force?
2006.
Okay.
And at the time, I kind of got informed that I was going to get a Labrador or I was going to find something else to do. And I really didn't want one. Like, I really didn't want a lab. I was a pointy person, right? Like, that's mortifying. And it once again in my life, things kind of just lined out the way they were supposed to. Within a few weeks of being accepted out of the task force, one of my mentors and I stumbled upon this yellow lab. And when she and I went out to screen him, he had come out of a shelter. We went out to screen him, and she said, "He's either going in your car or mine." And I said, "Oh, mine. Oh, if you like him, he's going home with me."
Yeah.
And we worked our way through federal certification for disaster response. And then he also then did wilderness response as well.
Okay, and did he do Life Find or HR?
Live find.
Okay,
Live
cool.
find. So he was my first, like, go in the world and really do the searching live find dog. And I learned a ton from him. Again, a very difficult dog to train. There were many times that I heard, "Hey, we were pretty sure the dog could do it. We weren't real sure that you were going to make it." And so we struggled through that. And then I decided a lady was retiring. My first dog was retiring due to an injury. She had a CCL tear. And I said, "Well, I really want to still have a human remains dog because I just love that." And a Malinois walked his way into my life. He was an extreme challenge. And he really taught me that I'm a Labrador handler.
Surprise.
That was a hard thing for me to wrap my head around, but I really am a Labrador handler. But we did finish out his whole career, and we got to do some really fun things. And because I was on the task force and I had a certified human remains detection dog, we were able to go help out at a couple of searches that were disaster related that needed human remains dogs. We didn't have those really yet. And so he was able to respond to the Bastrop wildfire with me. I think that was in 2011, maybe. And the Joplin tornadoes. So I got to do some human remains in a disaster environment. And I went, "Man, this is where it's at. I love this so much." When I started to retire him, I started working a young yellow lab in human remains detection, specifically for disaster, because I said, "Man, you know, we did this with this wilderness trained dog, but I think we can do it better. I think there's a way to make this dog really good for disaster response, which is what I want to do, and very different than wilderness response." So she helped me learn some new training methodologies, and really the dogs that we use now for human remains detection in a disaster environment, when you see them work, it's like an Ersatz dog. They're big running dogs that are looking for large sources or fresh sources in an unstable environment. So it looks very different than what I had become accustomed to in a human remains detection on the wilderness side, which was much more methodical. And you're
Right.
looking for buried remains that are who knows how old, a very different thing. So I worked that little yellow lab. She retired a few years ago, due to an injury. And while I was working her, I tripped over a dog. Oh, I won't do this one again. I had a German Shorthair Pointer, and I made him my Urban Search and Rescue live find dog. He had been in TSA's bomb dog program, and he was flunking out. And they said, "You know, he will climb on anything and he really loves to tug." Well, what I didn't know was what they meant was he won't out a toy ever.
He just holds on to it
And they
forever.
couldn't keep him. They couldn't keep him, right? Because of that, they were going to wash him out of their program. And I was like, oh, well, I mean, technically it's tugging when he just won't give it back. Well, he can do this. Let's do it. So I worked him in urban search and rescue live find. I tried very hard to also get him to do wilderness, but here's what I learned. When you take a dog that has been bred for probably centuries to chase small game, they're going to chase small game no matter what. And I could never really get it out of him at a level that I felt like we were really searching for people. It really felt like when you're wandering through the woods with him, that you were stumbling from a squirrel to a quail to a rabbit to, and then he'd look up and be like, hey, there's a person out here. Would you like me to tell you about that? I'm like, okay, this is not how we're going to do. This is not reliable. So I never did certify him for wilderness work. He retired a few years ago, and I started working one of my current live find partners, Mystery. She's a black lab female who is an outstanding partner. And then I, when Callie retired due to her injury, I started working Canyon. He's a male yellow lab. He's my certified human remains detection dog right now. He does both he and Mystery do urban search and rescue and wilderness search and rescue. And then I've got a new guy in training kind of coming up behind Mystery. He is a yellow lab who will be doing live find. So that's kind of the gang. There have been a couple in between that I have like co-certified with someone, right? If they had this nice certified dog that was ready for USAR and their schedule changed or their life changed and they just couldn't deploy anymore. And so they would let me certify with that dog and use it as a backup plan in case mine got hurt, which is excellent experience.
Cool. So yeah, you were definitely a lab person, but I think this is good because
I
it
am
sets a
now,
good
yeah.
context. Yeah, it sets a good context for the stuff we're going to talk about here in just a minute. Specifically around evaluating dogs, because you've a German Shepherd, a Chow mix, a GSP, a lab, so you've and a Mal, so you've kind of spanned the gamut of kind of the typical SAR dog. So then with that, let's get into the actual purpose of the episode. So you mentioned earlier you are part of a team named Category 5. So I want you to talk just for a minute about Category 5. And then tell us at a high level, what are the goals of the organization, as well as how it was founded, when it was founded. So tell us about the organization in totality.
All right. So Category 5 was founded in 2019 by a group of handlers who were all with Texas A&M Task Force 1. We were looking for ways to support our task force canine handlers and find dogs to be able to do urban search and rescue. And we're all very passionate about getting dogs who are in rescue situations or owner surrender situations and helping them find productive jobs. Many, many dogs exist in the world that can do great things in working situations that wind up stuck in a pet home for one reason or another. And they often wind up in shelters because they're just not good at being pets. And so we are very passionate about finding those dogs and getting them into productivity, into healthy, safe, productive places. So we said, how do we do all those things? And we sat down and we put together a nonprofit. And then we went to work. And our first order of business was rescuing dogs because we love doing that. And I already had a fairly good network throughout Texas of shelters who would let me look at dogs. Prior to founding Category 5, I had been pulling dogs kind of through my, I had a, at the time, a pet dog training business, and I would just pull them in and say, hey, let me just train on them for a while. We'll find them the right placement and we'll push them from there. And so I was placing dogs with bomb dog agencies and bed bug detection agencies from shelters all over the state. And so we turned those contacts into a start for Category 5. And we have since worked with dozens of shelters all over the country, which is really fun. And we take those dogs, and when we bring a dog in-house, we spend a little bit of time with them, getting to know them and figuring out what kind of job they really want. Initially, we were specifically looking for urban search and rescue dogs. So we would get them in, hope they were going to do urban search and rescue. And then when they wouldn't, or if they were close but not quite, we would try to match them up with trainers or programs that would take them. And one of the fun things that we're experiencing is our network of people who are willing to take shelter dogs and pull them into their detection programs is growing and growing. Mm-hmm. And that is so exciting. When I went to search for that second dog, that little chow mix, I really wanted to adopt a dog from a shelter. And that would have been in 2004. Well, in 2004, I could not find a single shelter in this state that would give me a dog because I said I was going to work them. And they said, oh, no, he can't be a working dog. That's cruel.
Oh.
And I went, no, you don't understand. He's going to live in my house. He's going to sleep on my couch. He's also going to go play in the forest and look for people.
Mm-hmm.
Said, nope, nobody would give me a dog. I found one person who had this chow mix that had literally been thrown out of a vehicle driving down the highway, and they just scooped it up off the side of the road and said, here, take it. So from then until now we have shelters intentionally reaching out to try to place dogs that they know are not going to be good pets. And that is such an exciting change to see in the industry, that people are starting to realize being a working dog is not cruel and inhumane. It's a great life, and that's where these dogs really need to be successful. So that's been a super fun thing that we've gotten to see through Cat 5. And we hope we get to continue doing that. We're also super excited that we get to provide a ton of support for the handlers of Texas Task Force 1. Things like everything from first aid kits that will help them with their dogs when they're out working, to workshops and trainings like trigger point massage or, you know, field first aid care. So we're excited to be able to do all those things.
Cool. So I do want to clarify, because I heard you say it, but I want to make sure that it's crystal clear. So Cat 5 was originally founded with the purpose of finding shelter dogs and turning them into working dogs. Is that accurate? Because I think that's a pretty unique goal that you all have versus some other organizations. Is that right?
Yes, that was our primary goal, was to figure out how we could rescue dogs and get them into jobs.
Very good. All right. So just curious, how many dogs have you guys placed over the last 4 or 5 years, I think, that you've been around, and specifically in working homes and then maybe SAR homes specifically?
Okay, so we have placed 40 dogs since 2019.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have gone to be bomb dogs, drug dogs. Some of them are detecting contraband in schools. We've got dogs looking for invasive exotic species for wildlife detection. We've got some in USAR. We've got some in wilderness SAR. And that is really cool to get to see them succeeding in a wide variety of careers all across the country, frankly.
Okay, so then you've placed dogs. So, and I'll ask the question. So, it sounds like, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you've placed dogs in homes across the country. So it's not just Texas that you're placing dogs, and those dogs have gone to both what I'd call private homes, quote unquote, as well as companies that may do like bomb detection or narcotics detection. Is that right?
That's correct. So we have dogs that have been placed in everywhere from Oregon to Florida. Sometimes they go to individual handlers who are searching for their next partner for whatever that detection thing is, be it bed bugs or search and rescue. And then we've also got dogs that we have sent to programs that are training dogs for law enforcement and doing that full time. And then they'll take the dog and train it up and send it off to work for law enforcement full time.
All right, cool. So you mentioned that you have a network of shelters that you've historically worked with to get your dogs. Is that the only place that you generally get your dogs? Or if someone picks up a dog and they saw a cool mall on TV and then they realize that they were probably not the best fit for them, can they call you and make a referral and say, hey, can you take this dog? What does that process look like to get dogs to you?
They absolutely can. So we get dogs from a wide variety of places. So any shelter can contact us. Any individual that has a dog they want to surrender can contact us. Anybody that's with a rescue can contact us. And if you go to our website, which is cat5k9.org, letter K number 9, you will find on there some screening resources. And we basically posted a set of videos and said, if you have a dog that you think will work for us, take these videos. Here's how to do them. Send us those videos. So we'll get those videos in and we'll review those and get some basic information about the dog. How old is it? Where is it located? Who has it? And then we're going to try to look for some options. The first thing that we do is try to network that dog directly to trainers and handlers in the region the dog is from. So if we get a referral for a dog from South Dakota, we're going to try to find people that we've worked with before or that have sent us inquiries from neighboring states and say, is anybody interested in just going and seeing this dog in person, screening it, and pulling it directly from that rescue or that owner into your program? We prefer to do that because we have such a small group of fosters. We can only bring in so many dogs, and there are hundreds of them at any given time across the country. So we want to send them directly to wherever they're going to work and get them started there as fast as we can. So that's number one way. It's just some quick referrals around. And honestly, very few people actually see that. We don't put that stuff up on Facebook until we've gone through that set of handlers and trainers that we know are in a specific area looking for a dog. If nobody in the immediate area is looking for a dog, we're going to take the videos and the photos and the information, and we're going to post it up on our socials, and we're going to try to find a handler that is interested or a program that is interested in adopting that dog directly. We call that our flyby program because they kind of just fly right by us and go to work. And that is very successful for us. We've been super successful at helping dogs find their way to the right place without ever coming to us. We love that. If we have the ability to bring one in-house, or we think, hey, it's going to maybe be an urban search and rescue dog, what we see in the videos would make us believe that it's got what it takes to be an urban search and rescue dog. And if we happen to be looking for one for Texas A&M Task Force 1, then we'll try to bring the dog into our program here. Or if we have a local dog that is here in Texas close by and we say, hey, look, we've got room. We don't think he wants to do urban search and rescue, but we think we do have space and we want to commit to helping him or her find their way to their right program. We'll bring them into our program and we'll foster them in-house.
Okay.
That's where that 40 number comes from. The ones we've actually brought in-house is 40 and then adopted out.
Gotcha. And I'd assume that flyby number is probably much higher than
the
40.
It is. And I honestly have got no idea how high that number is. It makes my heart happy to find them a better place right off the bat.
So then you hit on an important point that I want to come to, and then we'll jump to how you go about screening the dogs. But you mentioned that there's people that will reach out to you to say, hey, I'd like a dog. So what does that process look like? Can Joe Schmo off the street reach out to say, I want a dog? Did he have to fill out an application? Is it just businesses or organizations or law enforcement agencies? If someone wants to get a dog from you that they know has been formerly a shelter dog or a surrender, how do they reach out to you and what type of questions do they ask and are you asking them?
Excellent question. So there are two applications that live on the website. One is for a handler that is looking for a dog. Actually, three applications. One for a handler that's looking for a dog. One for a program that is looking for a dog. And then the third one is someone who wants to adopt a dog that didn't quite make it. Okay. We have some folks that really love to have very active sport type dogs, and they like our washouts. So those three things exist on the website. You put that in, we add you onto our database of who's looking for dogs and who's potentially interested. And then if we come across a match, we're going to get in touch with that person and try to get them matched correctly. Sometimes when we have a dog in-house that we have been getting ready for detection stuff, we won't have a match for him within the trainers that have already put in requests for dogs. Then we will post that person up on our socials to try, or post that dog up on the socials so that we can try and find him or her the right spot to go. Sometimes that's very quick. Sometimes it takes many, many months. And for the dogs that we bring in house, it's common for us to have those dogs for like 4 to 6 months at the least. Often it's longer than that. And so it can be a really long process, which means we don't have tons of turnover. Which means a lot of dogs are still out there waiting to come here. So as far as like, if people have questions, there's also info emails on the website, cat5canine.org. And you can just hit us up at that email address and just ask us whatever questions you have. I promise someone has asked something stranger than whatever you were thinking about. I promise. And we're happy to answer questions.
Okay, well, I'm going to send an email and say, I would like a dog that likes to be rewarded with golf clubs. Do you
have one? I love it. Being available?
So then I assume that you have a decent sized network of fosters, because obviously, you know, you can't have 30 dogs. Maybe you do. I don't know. But
we don't. We don't.
Maybe you don't have 30 dogs at your house, but I'm assuming you have a network of fosters that whenever you bring dogs in, that you send them out to foster. So assuming that those fosters are relatively close to you, is are you looking for additional fosters to help with the program as well?
You know, some of us do live fairly close. Most of the fosters are in Texas, but we do have a couple fosters that are out of state. Mm-hmm. They tend to be search dog handlers that are interested in a dog that we've pushed toward them, but they don't quite want to commit yet. And so they want to foster to potentially adopt the dog. So we've done that in the past as well, right? Hey, I'm interested in this dog from this shelter, but if it doesn't work out, I need some way to be able to keep it moving down the road to wherever it's going to wind up. So we have a very few out-of-state fosters doing that. We love a good foster, especially somebody that is really good with working dogs. We are very hard on our screening process to become a foster. We're going to ask tons of questions. We're going to call tons of references to make sure that you are really ready to bring this monster into your house, because it's a lot. When they first come out of the shelter and they don't know how to do anything, but they have all this drive that is absolutely manifesting in the worst ways possible, it's a lot. And if you're not prepared for that, things can go catastrophically bad. And we don't want to have that happen. So if anybody's interested in fostering, they can shoot us an email, category5canines@gmail.com.
Good deal. So then let's get into the meat and potatoes. Let's talk about the screening process, because I know for a fact that there are plenty of SAR handlers out there that say, I would like a search dog, and I'd much prefer that dog to be either a rescue or from a shelter, wherever the case may be. And there's multiple reasons for that. Maybe because of the cost of buying a puppy can be pretty expensive, or maybe it's just a passion of theirs to get dogs and not feel the need to create new dogs when there's plenty of dogs available. So what I'd like to do is walk through the screening process in depth that you ask people to go to. And actually, I'll rephrase this question. Let's say that you're going to a shelter tomorrow and you're going to look for dogs. What is step one that you're going to take? And let's walk through every single step of that process.
So the first thing is, we don't show up at a shelter without people knowing what we're looking for. We're going to contact the shelter manager before we go and make sure they know, hey, we're looking for potential working candidates. This is what our rescue dog does. Are you okay with us coming to take a look at dogs? Some are going to say yes. A couple are still on the no bus, but we're getting closer to having everybody on board. So we'll talk to them and be real straightforward about what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. Often they will have a list of dogs already that they're like, oh, you want a dog that really is into toys and playing with toys? Oh, it's this one. Go take a look at this one. Great. I'll be there tomorrow. So when I arrive, the first thing I'm going to do is go ahead and take a look at whatever they suggest is going to work. I'm also going to take note of how long that dog has been at that shelter. Many dogs that have been at a shelter long term are going to look like they have really good drive because they've been stuck in a kennel for a very long time with nothing fun to do. And suddenly someone showed up and was willing to throw a toy for them. Mm-hmm. So they're going to chase that toy and they're going to possess that toy. Often when you get that dog into a new environment, it's going to completely fall apart. He's going to go, oh my gosh, there's so much happening and I'm so distracted. So I'm going to note that. It's not going to be a deal breaker, but I'm going to make sure I know that that's what's going on. If I like that dog, I'm going to ask if I can do an offsite screening with that dog and see if I see the same things. If the dog's drive still looks good away from the shelter, I'm going to pull it into the program in some way.
So let me interject a question then. Mm-hmm. So you're there at the shelter and yep. You're looking at this dog. What are you looking at to determine if you like that dog? What are you doing?
That's a great question. So let's assume I went into this shelter cold and I don't know anything. Mm-hmm. The first thing I'm going to do is just walk down the aisle between the kennels, bouncing a tennis ball. And there's going to be a lot of screaming because there's always a lot of screaming in a kennel at the shelter. But as you bounce the ball, you will see a couple of dogs, just a couple, latch onto that tennis ball and just watch it. And they're really watching it bounce. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm going to then hold the tennis ball up next to the kennel, not where I can get my fingers bit, but next to the kennel. And I'm going to see if he's really trying to get it. Sometimes they'll sniff it and be like, wow, that's stupid. Why would anyone be interested in that ball? And then suddenly they're out. If they look like they want to grab a hold of the ball, I'm going to ask if I can take the dog out to a play yard. And we're going to go out to a play yard. Sometimes you have a very tiny space. Sometimes you have a big, beautiful play yard. Just depends on what the shelter has. But I'm going to go out in that yard and I'm going to take the dog off leash. I'm going to give him exactly 1 minute to acclimate. He gets to run around that yard, go to the bathroom, do whatever he wants to do, but he gets 1 minute. Mm-hmm. And I'm timing it. Then I'm going to take that tennis ball and I'm just going to bounce it right in front of him. So he's going to see it. Does he go get it? If he doesn't, he's going right back to the kennel.
Mm-hmm.
If he does, and he's really into it, I'm probably going to have to chase him down and tackle him to get it back. That's a great sign. That's a great sign. So I'm going to try to do 10 retrieves with the dog. And what I'm talking about is I'm going to try to grab onto his collar and hang onto his collar. I'm going to throw the tennis ball to a place that he can easily see it land. Short grass, not far in front of him. Once it stopped moving, I'm going to let go of the dog so that he can run over and grab it. I'm going to repeat that 10 times. I do not care if he brings it back to me or if I have to run him down and chase him and tackle him every time. Really don't care. Retrieving at this point is not the point. Going and getting the toy is the point. So if he makes it through those 10 retrieves, I'm going to just let him have that toy and I'm going to ignore him and I'm going to watch what he does for a minute with that toy while I ignore him. Does he drop it and go do something else? If he does, probably doesn't want to come into our program. He's probably more like a sport candidate where he has a lot of prey drive, but not a lot of possession. And so he doesn't really want that toy. So I'll just watch him for that minute with that toy and see what he's going to do. If he makes it through that, I'm going to want to try to see if he's willing to hunt for that toy. In a shelter situation, I may have to get really creative about how I do that.
So before you transition, let me ask real quick. On that minute, are you looking for him to possess it? Or what if he brings it back to you and drops it at your feet and stares at you or barks or whines? Or you just want him to possess it?
That is really still possession. If he is still engaged with the toy, I'm happy.
Okay.
Right. And if he's asking me to touch it and do something with it, that's still being engaged with that toy.
Okay, cool.
What I don't want to see is him drop it and go wander off to sniff something.
Gotcha.
That is not ideal. So, so when we go to do the hunt stuff, I'm going to look around and see what I have. Each place is unique. And so you have to get a little creative about this, but I want to be able to toss the ball somewhere that he's not necessarily going to see it right away when it lands. Maybe that's a little tall grass in the back of the yard. Maybe that's into a kiddie pool that's in the back corner of the play yard. I often travel with a big plastic tarp that I will take in. Like I'll bring that into the pen at this point and I'll kind of flap it around and see if I'm scaring him with it. If I'm scaring him with it, he's probably not going to make it as a working dog.
Mm-hmm.
I'll set that tarp down in just like a big heap in the corner and I'll pull him back to the other side of the pen, hang on to him and toss that tennis ball onto the tarp so that it kind of crunches down in there a little bit and he won't see it right away. He's going to have to look a little bit. As soon as it's landed, I'm going to release him and let him go. And I want to see if he is trying to find it. He doesn't have to succeed. Dogs are not actually born knowing how to use their noses. They have to learn how to do that. And when they come from a pet home, they don't always learn how to do that. So I may have to teach him how to use his nose later on. But in the meantime, I want to see, is he willing to look for it? And again, I'm timing this. I want to see him be willing to look for at least a minute. If he's willing to do that, then I'm going to go do some environmental testing. I'm going to put a leash on him and I'm going to ask the shelter manager if I can take that dog to just walk around some places and see how he handles it. We're going to go in the bathroom. I'm going to shut off the lights and slam the door and drop a bucket. I'm going to ask him to jump up on a picnic table and see if he's willing to get up on a picnic table or crawl through a little dog door in the back of the place. Whatever I can find at that facility to see how he's going to handle a lot of different environmental stimulus, I'm going to use.
Mm-hmm.
And then I am going to ask, okay, he's passed all the tests so far, but I really want to see him off site. Because again, he may be comfortable in this location, but when I take him somewhere new, it can change very drastically. Some shelters are fine with that. Some shelters are not. You have to decide before you pull this dog how comfortable you are with what you see and your potential to be able to either bring him back if he doesn't work out or place him in some other kind of placement if working isn't going to be his thing. So if I can do an offsite, we're going to go somewhere nearby and look at all the same things. I've probably got him on a long line and a harness to do it because he's not going to recall and I don't want to lose him.
Right.
So we're doing all those things again, retrieves, possession, hunts, checking out environmental stimulus as much as I can. Sometimes they'll give me a time limit, like, hey, you've got an hour to have him back, or, oh, hey, we're going to have you sign up to be a foster and you take him overnight and foster him. And then if it doesn't work out, you can bring him back in the morning. And some of them will just straight up tell you, if you want him, you adopt him. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is part of why we built Cat 5, right? There are places that we wanted to be able to pull dogs from, but have a mechanism by which we could get them adopted out fairly easy, as opposed to if Christy Borman as an individual just has this dog, it could be hard for me to find him the right placement.
Right.
So that's basically the screening that we do. And if we have somebody that we know is looking for a very specific type of dog or for a very specific type of environment, we'll do what we can to get the dog to that or mimic that to the best of our ability. Once we bring the dog into our program, let's say we physically bring it into our program, then we're going to start our kind of testing phase. And we're doing a couple things. One is trying to get them healthy. Many of these dogs come to us in condition that is just not ideal. They might be grossly obese. They might be severely emaciated. They could have heartworms. Who knows what's going on? But we're starting to work at getting them healthy. And then a couple times a week, we're taking them out somewhere and saying, how do you feel about Tractor Supply, friend? Are you comfortable at Tractor Supply? And if they say yes, well, then that tells us, hey, they can probably work out in public and they can probably handle being around people in a detection type job. We might take them to a rest stop and just get them out around traffic or take them up to the grocery store and walk them around the parking lot while there's people in carts all over the place. We're just looking to see what the dog says, yes, I'm comfortable with, or no, I'm not comfortable with this, because that helps us narrow down what kind of job they would like to end up doing. Once we know all those things, we're going to try to match them up with a program. And if anybody's interested in seeing those exact screening tests, there are videos on our website that are built to walk you through how to do that. We love, love, love for people to share those. So one of the ways that you can help us is by sending those videos out to people, to shelters or to places that, you know, maybe they have a dog and you might be interested in it. You feel free to use those videos to send them and say, send me back these videos and I'll see if I'm actually interested in this dog. Please feel free to do that. We want them to be used that way.
Okay, cool. So then if someone's listening and they're in Minnesota or something, and maybe they live, you know, around the corner from a shelter, they could go through this process, videotape a specific dog, send it to you, and then you may be able to bring it into your program or use the flyby and see if there's someone local, correct? So anyone can send you a video of doing a screening of a dog. Is that right?
That is correct. So we love for shelter volunteers to share that with other folks they're volunteering with. If you can go spend an hour or so screening dogs at your shelter, that may help them find the right kind of placements if they need to be working dogs.
Cool. Cool. So then you now have the dog in your program. Let's say you're bringing it to your local program there, maybe staying at your house or with a local foster. But you don't know what type of program is going to go into, or excuse me, what type of job is going to go into. What do you look for then to say, well, this dog may be good for USAR versus wilderness or bed bug detection? What are you looking for in those dogs to kind of determine that?
So we are looking at their drive level in the various environments that we take them in and their focus level.
Mm-hmm.
Are they able to pay attention to me for even 1 second in the parking lot of the grocery store? If they are, I can build on that. If they are fearful of things, I need to note that, because if I have a dog that is afraid to walk into a tractor supply store, there's no way he's going to go do contraband detection in a school. It's right. Just not going to happen. So as we go through environments, we're really looking for, are they fearful in the environment? Are they still driven to get that toy? Are they willing to hunt for that toy in that environment, in whatever way we can set that up? And then we start taking notes about what are they comfortable with or not comfortable with? How does that match up with the people that we have on the list and what they're usually looking for?
Okay.
So that we can make the best match possible.
How many people do you generally have on your list of looking for dogs?
You know, it depends. I would be willing to bet of the 40 dogs we've placed, there have only been a couple places that have taken two of them. So we always start with the folks that, if they have a program and we understand what the program is looking for, we're going to go, hey, look, here's this dog. He's a match for your program. We know that you're going through many, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or folks that have emailed and said, hey, I'm looking for my next wilderness star dog. We go, yes, he really wants to be a wilderness star dog. Let's start talking to those. And I'll be honest, I am not the keeper of the list. So I don't really know how many people are on it or off it at any given time. And it flexes a lot because, you know, people are going to find what matches for them and then off they go.
Sure. All right. That's fair. So then do you all do any training of the dog? So I guess I'm thinking like you're probably not doing narcotics training because you all at Cat 5 are SAR handlers, but mm-hmm. but perhaps you start USAR training or wilderness SAR training. Do you do any training of the dogs, or are you providing just green dogs and maybe with some obedience training?
Right. Very, very little training is done on them before they get matched with their program. Partly because we are all wildly overwhelmed with dogs that we have to do other things with.
Yep.
And partly because we don't want to train them in a way that is going to be different than what the program is looking for. Obviously, one of the things that we know about dog trainers is no two of them agree, which means they're all wanting to train things differently.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want me to teach him a lot of things before they get him. They want to do it. So for the most part, it's green dogs. We have on occasion started dogs for USAR with the hopes that they will be a match for one of our Texas handlers. And sometimes those matches just don't work out, right? It's like a marriage. Sometimes the match is just not meant to be. And so we have had dogs that are started for USAR that we have sent to other teams to match with other handlers. But that's very rare.
Okay, cool. Do you all do any health testing?
We do. So when we first get the dogs in, some shelters have done some pretty extensive health testing, and some of them have done almost none. So when we get the dogs in, we're going to do things like make sure everybody is fully vaccinated. We're going to have to quarantine them, especially if they're coming out of a shelter. We're going to test for all of the normal things like parasites and tick-borne illnesses and things that are endemic to the region where the dog is coming from, so that we know what things this dog has. If we think that the dog would like to do USAR, and we will get pretty far into screening the dog for USAR before we do this, but if we think the dog might do USAR, we'll go ahead and do hip and elbow x-rays,
mm-hmm.
but that's super expensive. So we tend to only do that for the ones that are going to USAR. Typically, other programs don't care so much or are willing to do it themselves. So we have had some folks say, hey, look, we're interested in this dog. Can you take it to the vet if we're willing to pay for those x-rays? Yes, absolutely. We'll do that. And then if the x-rays look great, they'll pull the dog in. And if they don't, well, then they don't.
Okay. I'm curious if you know about what your success rate is. And by success, I mean the dog goes to a working home and doesn't wash out, or the dogs that you've actually brought into your program, maybe finger in the air guess.
Oh, gosh. I would guess in the neighborhood of 70%, but it's a guess. And it goes in waves, honestly. Sometimes we've pulled in some dogs just out of rescues and gone, look, it's just, this dog is a big behavioral mess. Let's just pull it in here and try to get it healthy enough and see, can we behaviorally help this dog become functional or not? And so we know it's a stretch. Those dogs, man, that's a toss up, right?
Yeah.
If you go into it knowing that it's a maybe, it's going to stay a maybe for a while.
Right.
We've got one dog right now that is one of my favorites. I just adore him. He is a lab shepherd mix. And we started him for USAR. and he did not match well with the handler that we had in mind. He's super duper crate reactive, very crate reactive. And so we've been looking for the right placement of someone who can handle that and a dog that is super high drive. Gosh, we've had him for, I think, a year and a half or maybe even 2 years. And he's still hanging out. He's still doing a little bit of work, enough work to keep his brain active while we try to find that. And so some of these matches can be really hard to make when they come with baggage like that. And almost every shelter dog is going to come with some kind of baggage.
Right. If someone is out there and they say, I really love shelter dogs and I love working dogs, you've mentioned multiple ways of how they can help, but I'm going to ask you to restate those. So they love your mission. They love what you do. They love dogs. How can people who maybe listen to this episode help Cat5? What are the ways? I'm going to ask you to list them in detail, please.
Absolutely. The number one thing you can do to help Cat5 is to help spread the word about Cat5. Share our socials or share our screening process with people that are in shelters nearby you. The more people that know that shelter dogs and rescue dogs can go do really cool jobs, the better off we are, because we can find those dogs, get them identified, and get them channeled to the places they're going to be successful. Mm-hmm. We often hear about dogs that are, I call them either frequent flyers or repeat offenders. They wind up getting adopted, and then they get returned, and then they get adopted, and then they get returned, and then they get adopted, and they get traded on Facebook Marketplace somewhere. That's no kind of life for a dog. So we want to take those dogs. Many of those dogs are going to wind up being successful in jobs, because what makes them not stick in a pet home is their insane drive level. And if you don't give that insane drive level a good, healthy outlet, they'll make their own up, and it's never good. It's like, I get super excited when a foster calls me and is like, yeah, he ate the drywall in the bathroom yesterday. I'm like, oh, cool. He's probably going to be great. Yeah. Can't wait to see the videos. So number one is spread the word about what we're doing. Number two is please, please, please feel free to use those screenings to get yourself a dog, get somebody on your team a dog. If you have a screening test that you would like to see added to our stuff, send that to us. We'll record it. We'll help share the word about your specific screening tests, because our goal is not to get us dogs. Our goal is to get dogs out of shelters and into jobs. Mm-hmm. Number three, I guess, is donate. We are a nonprofit, and it is very expensive to get these dogs healthy and to work and to support the search team. So we're always looking for donations. We've got a donate button on the webpage, and we have a super fun annual fundraiser that will be coming up suit later this spring called Dogs That Make Us Drink. And we would love to have you participate in Dogs That Make Us Drink. So follow our socials. You'll be able to see all of the information on that as it comes out. We would love to have you participate.
All right, cool. So one of the things we like to do is give you the opportunity to talk about some cool things that either your dogs have done on actual searches, or maybe some of the Cat5 graduates have done on actual searches. So this is your opportunity to brag. So tell us a story or two.
Oh, very cool. So one of our favorite placements is actually a dog that was in a shelter. He got recruited by a group that was hoping to train him as a PTSD service dog. And when they got him out of the shelter and away from the shelter, his drive level popped up and he was crazy. Mm-hmm. So we'd worked with them before, and they reached out to us and said, hey, would you guys be interested in screening him? And they brought him over, and we said, yeah, he looks pretty good. We'll take him. And we worked with him for 4 or 5 months, I think. And now, a super cool thing, he is up in Washington and Oregon looking for invasive species of mussels on boats and around lakes. So he is helping protect those lakes by stopping the transport of those invasive mussels, which is so cool. 20 years ago, that is not a thing we would have ever thought about a dog being able to do, let alone a shelter dog go be able to do it. So it's just really fun to get to watch them succeed. You know, it's very rewarding for me also. The ones that do wind up sticking with Texas A&M Task Force 1 and becoming our USAR dogs, it's so cool to get to watch that dog go from monster that someone threw away to this elite response athlete and then get to go on deployments with them to some of the biggest disasters in the country and say, look, that throwaway dog is out there trying to save lives. There's just nothing better than that. It's Ooh. So cool.
Yeah, good deal. How many do you know graduates of Cat 5 are on Texas One?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. It's at least 7, and I'm probably undercounting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9. We have 9 Cat 5 graduates on Texas A&M Task Force One.
Cool. Good deal. Yeah. Good deal. All right. Well, final question, and you've mentioned it, but I'll ask you to repeat it again. If people have questions, they want to help contribute to Cat 5, they want to adopt a dog, they want to recommend a dog, how do people contact you?
So if you guys want to reach out to us, we would love to hear from you in any form or fashion. The first thing you should do is check out our website, which is cat, C-A-T, the number 5, the letter K, and the number 9.org. You can also follow us on socials. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, I believe. We often post fun facts about the organization and what we're doing, or videos of our current dogs or our alumni and what they are up to. So you will be able to follow along with all those fun things. We've also got lots of interesting content that is starting to come out on our blog and on our YouTube channel. So pay attention to that, because I think you can share a lot with us about things that you are doing that are similar to what we're doing, and we can all go get better at this search and rescue thing.
Very good. Well, thank you so much, Chrissy. This has been an amazing interview. We really appreciate you taking the time. And thank you for the mission that yourself and the other folks at Cat 5 are pursuing to turn shelter dogs into working dogs. It's really great work. So thank you again.
We are happy that we are able to do it, and we love that it is as useful as it is in the world.
Good deal. And thank you to all the listeners for listening to Hunt, Find, Alert. As always, we appreciate your support. We appreciate the kind words that you've been sending. And we'll see you out there next time. Safe searching.